Live from my swamp to yours, it's the Other Animals for October 2nd, 2020. I'm Laurent Levy. Thanks for checking us out today. Yep, back in the swamp, just playing it safe for now, like a lot of people, hoping to return to some semblance of normalcy soon. You know, I saw an interesting piece the other day warning that, alas, there is no getting back to normal, and that the sooner we accept that, the better. We apparently are hardwired to believe that we will, though, and even have some elaborate labels to describe that phenomenon, including, listen to this, hedonic adaptation, which lets us quickly adapt and not constantly see all relatively new things as threats, so we don't miss the newer, bigger ones, and another one called normalcy bias, which makes us believe that change is temporary. I don't know. Historically, we always seem to find some kind of normalcy. It's just that it's a different normal. Whatever you call it, wouldn't it be nice if we could just get there a bit quicker? Well, as we all anxiously await the development of the vaccine, it turns out that we have baked into this trial process a particular phase that can add anywhere from 3 to 6 years that is actually unreliable and unnecessary. And I'll bet you can guess what that phase might involve. So our dear friend, our old friend, Dr. Aisha Akhtar is going to tell us about human biology methods that her new organization is pioneering. And also very thrilled to be able to talk with Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society about his extraordinary efforts confronting whalers and his controversial new book, Orcapedia, that explores the similarities between orca captivity and the slave trade. And a bit later, Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls will continue his series on common but easy to miss pet maladies. And today he's going to be looking at dogs. But before we get to any of that, it's time for Animals in the News. All right, now here to catch us up after last week's hiatus is our very own Dina Blumenthal. Hey, Dina, how's it going?
Hey, Laurent, how are you?
Good. All right, what goodies do you have for us this week?
I've got all birds for us this week. How's that?
Birds, bring it on.
Birds.
Why not?
All right, let's start with a local one. So hundreds of thousands of birds have been migrating across Pennsylvania in the last week or so, the last couple weeks of September. The Pennsylvania migration is part of a transcontinental mass movement of nearly 900 million birds. The birds are orioles, warblers, sparrows, and tanagers. Begins in late July, goes through the end of November, but peaks the last week of September through the beginning of October, so now in PA. They were expecting, about 50,000 birds were expected to fly over Philadelphia last week. And this is something that happens every year. So I don't know if you've ever seen it. I don't remember ever seeing it, but it happens at night, so it's hard to see.
Do they, if you have like bird feeders and stuff like that, will they come check you out? Is there anything you got to do to entice them? But do you, go ahead. Yeah.
I think I think the idea is let them do it at night because, it's less dangerous for them. So they tend to fly at night for that reason. You can go listen to them.
Listen to them?
You can hear them, which is really interesting. And you're encouraged to turn your lights, your outdoor lights off, because the light pollution in and around cities can disorient them and cause them to sometimes like run into buildings, things like that. Mm-hmm. So they're moving to South America and they're seeking better resources on mostly food. So they take advantage of the growing season here and then they move on to South America. So maybe awesome. Something to, you can still go and try to listen. I'm kind of jealous. So
I think that's something
I would check out.
Is it a sound of like a swarm? Is it a really distinctive sound or do they have a unique song that, you know what I mean? Do we know?
Well, I think maybe since it's different birds, I don't know that it'd be one united song, but yeah. It's, I don't know. You're there. I'm not there anymore. Yeah. I'm over in Portland, Oregon.
We'll have to get the mics
out. Turn off your outdoor lights.
There you go. All right, cool. You got another one?
All right.
Another bird story. Here
I
we go.
love the title of this one. Foul-mouthed parrots to return to park, possibly reformed.
Love it.
All right. A group of African gray parrots, Billy, Elsie, Eric, Jade, and Tyson, who were recently moved to Wildlife Park about 130 miles north of London, suddenly started cursing just a few days after they'd arrived. The chief executive at the park, Nicole, heard them from the other room and thought, oh, I have a bunch of employees cursing. I need to go tell them to stop. But when he went to check, nobody was there. So what happened? Well, people loved it. People started swearing right back at them and laughing because it's funny when parrots curse. So then the parrots picked up the laughing. So now you've got five parrots together. One would say a curse word and the other would laugh and back and forth. And it would just be this hilarious cacophony of swearing. So Nichols, the executive, said, if you get five together, once one swears and another one laughs and another one laughs, before you know it, it sounds like a group of teenagers or an old working men's club.
So, a group of sailors. Yeah, but the same idea.
Like a group
yeah.
of sailors. So they moved them to this temporary space away from the public so they'd be with other birds who didn't curse all the time. So the birds, though they would remember these curse words, they would just get more used to now imitating these nicer words.
The nun
so,
birds and the
nun
birds. Yeah, yeah, okay.
And apparently people who'd, you know, heard about these birds would come to try to find them and to try to listen to them, and not knowing which ones they were, they would just try cursing at different birds throughout the wildlife center to see who responded. But that did not work. But anyway, the article came out a few days ago, but supposedly the birds were released back into the main, you know, the main colony on Wednesday after their time removed for bad behavior.
Did they have a sense of where they picked up their foul language in the first place? Or it was just
It sounded like, I think that they were donated from a person. So I think the person said, oh, sorry if they had a few bad words, but maybe it just, maybe they picked up more than the person realized. And then and all of this positive reinforcement of people laughing and just went for it.
It's interesting, you know, that the laughter is the positive reinforcement and that the birds have that sense, you know, to understand that.
Right.
All right. Hey, thanks, Dina.
That's what
that,
I thought
that was
too.
That was a lot of fun. Look forward to hearing from you again and the next time we get together. All right. Hey, listen. As you can guess, we're another tight week here. So we want to get right to our conversation with Aisha Akhtar really fascinating conversation here and really timely. You're going to hear about different methods, different techniques that for bringing drugs to market and other testing that does not necessarily involve animals. So here now is my conversation with Aisha Akhtar. Aisha Akhtar is a double board certified neurologist and preventative medicine specialist with a background in public health, and she's a U.S. veteran. She previously served as deputy director of the U.S. Army Traumatic Brain Injury Program, developing the Army's brain injury prevention and treatment strategies for soldiers. As a commander in the U.S. Public Health Service Commissioned Corps, Dr. Akhtar frequently deployed to assist with national public health emergencies. She's a fellow of the Oxford Center for Animal Ethics and the author of two books, Our Symphony with Animals, on health empathy and our shared destinies, and Animals in Public Health, which argues for the need for health institutions to include animals as part of the public in public health. And she's now the president and CEO of the Center for Contemporary Sciences, which is what we're going to talk about today. Aisha, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much, Lawrence.
All right. Well, let's catch up. So last time we spoke, which was a little over 6 months ago, it was back in March, we were just kind of beginning to get our arms around the reality, I guess we'd call it, of wet markets and their role in the whole COVID pandemic. Now, it's about 6 months, 6-7 months later, something like that. And I'm wondering if we have any benefit to hindsight. Are we seeing anything? Is the memo getting out? Are we learning anything? Has anything changed in that span?
So you're absolutely right. There, you know, we talked about how COVID-19 and most of the emerging infectious diseases that we are experiencing now and seeing coming out now are as a result of our treatment of other animals, whether we're talking about animals in the live markets, animals in the wildlife trade, and animals in factory farming. All of those aspects have a tremendous role in increasing our risk for new infectious diseases like the novel coronavirus we're experiencing now. Since the virus became, it caused an epidemic, caused a pandemic, there has been some increased awareness about the link between the emergence of the virus and viruses in general, and with the wildlife trade, the wet market, and even factory farming. Most of that awareness is, as we would expect, is happening in the UK, not in the US. Most of the news reports, articles in mainstream media are in the UK. We've seen very little of that in the US. Not to say there hasn't been any, but there have been very little. Mm-hmm. And most of that attention and focus was towards the beginning of the pandemic. And now the attention has shifted. Mm-hmm. You know, we find
has
that...
Has it fizzled or you know, or when you say shifted, has it looking elsewhere? You know, what's going on?
Oh, I say it's a reporter. It's the news. Oh. It's the news. I think it's up to them to decide what to report. They create the news in a sense, right? News agents create the news, and that becomes what we talk about. So they could, if they wanted to continue to make this connection.
Yeah.
They could continue to highlight why we need to fundamentally and urgently address our treatment of animals because of the risk that that imposes on human health. But our media have not been very interested in this issue in the first place, and certainly not having much of an interest in it.
I hate to use the animal reference, but there's a chicken and egg thing there. You know, it's like we have short attention span, you know, but why do we have short attention span? It's because the media likes to bounce us around, you know, with the news cycle, with 24-hour news cycle on to the next. Who's, you know, what's the origin of that? Who knows? You know, let's move on. So you've, in the interim, in the 6 months, you were just getting started when we last talked of setting up the Center for Contemporary Sciences. So bring us up to speed. What is that organization? What's its goals? What's its missions? What's your role? And
sure. So the Center for Contemporary Sciences, or CCS, was actually just launched this May. So we're a very new organization. We are a nonprofit organization, and our goal basically is to catalyze, create a widespread shift in medical research that basically begins and ends with human biology. And what that means is we are working with scientists and others to create a shift, that one that's needed for human health, in a way so that we are focusing on human biology, because we know that animal experimentation, not only is it cruel, but is not largely effective in understanding human biology, understanding the diseases that afflict us, and in finding the best therapies that we can find for our diseases.
Okay, so the focus, I'm hearing that the focus that we want to replace, what you're saying is it's essentially been a historically ineffective model of bringing a drug to market, which has always had this protocol of having an animal testing component. And I think what you're saying is that component, it's time to look at this in another way, that this it's been there for, we've had this traditionally, but it's fraught with problems.
So what I would say is we're looking at the use of animal across multiple areas. Now, one area is in pharmaceutical research, which is what you're referring to. It is not the largest use of animals, but it is a large use of animals. Now, what we are seeing is, despite the regulation in which the FDA normally requires a pharmaceutical company to test their new drug or vaccine on at least 2 species before they move to clinical trials, those animal tests are failing to predict what we're going to see in humans in clinical trials. Mm-hmm. In other words, more than 9 out of 10 drugs and vaccines that are found to be safe and effective in animals end up being unsafe or ineffective in humans.
And when it's been deemed ineffective on humans, that happens at the human phase of the trial. In other words, it's not after it's gone to market. It's that we've gone through these phases in the human trial. I'm sorry, in the animal trial, passes the animal trial, gets to the human trial, fails, and that's the end of it, right? It's not that it skips, that it then passes and it goes out into it gets approved, and then we get a whoops. That's not what you're describing, right?
The 90% failure rate is the failure rate that occurs at the clinical trial, the human trial.
At the human clinical trial. Okay. Yep.
So most of the drugs and vaccines that fail at the human trial level fail because of safety problems that were not discovered by animal tests, or they fail because they end up being ineffective in humans despite having been found effective in the animal tests that were done. Okay. Now, on top of that, multiple drugs do go out on the market and they can be recalled, and they have been recalled, or a black box label is added because of side effects or adverse effects that were not detected earlier.
Oh, okay. So what that all says, or what it suggests, it seems to me, is that the animal phase, even though it's been around for such a long time and it's part of the, you know, it's ingrained as part of the protocol, it's not effective. It's not an accurate marker, right? And because it's always been, I've never understood is why, it's one of these things that seems like that it's been around for so long that it's a victim of its own longevity, that it's, why would it be assumed that it would be a good marker, that would be a good indicator? I mean, and particularly, the incredible dependence on rats and mice, why would they even think that a rodent biology or physiology would be a marker for any type of trial when it to human?
It's baffling, isn't it? I mean, yeah. Who looked at a rat and said, oh my God, I'm going to test this rat because I think this rat is going to represent human biology. Yeah. I think that might have been the case when we were looking at basic things, basic anatomical features like heart and heart circulation. Yeah, there are significant differences, but there are overlaps. But now we've moved beyond that basic aspect of research. We're looking at the subtle nuances of molecular biology and genetic expression. Mm-hmm. And there is no getting around the fact that ultimately a rat is a rat, a monkey is a monkey, a dog is a dog, a cat is a cat, human is a human. Yeah. And even among humans, no one human is representative of all other humans. That's why clinical trials have to include a range of people, have to include black people, white people, men, women, people of different ethnic backgrounds, people of different ages, because there's so much variability within our own species. How can we possibly expect a completely different species to accurately predict what we're going to see in humans? And we are finding that that's the case. They are not, animal testing is not predicting what we're finding in humans. And the medical literature is there's more and more publications and studies that are showing that. So at CCS, what we are trying to do is help promote and create a shift in funding and strategies and investment into the creation of new technologies that are based on human biology that will be done before clinical trials, and that have a better chance of predicting what we're going to see in humans than the animal tests that are currently being done.
So what are you up against? That was like a massive culture shift in terms of the way, you know, we've always thought of bringing drugs and therapies to market. You're up against a lot of tradition, a lot of history. It sounds to me like you might also be up against the almighty dollar, that a lot of these corporations that have made a living out of genetically producing rats and mice would not be happy to see CCS coming around the corner.
Yeah, you know, I love it if we end up being, if some people start targeting us, that just says that we're being effective.
Yeah.
And we have to keep doing this. It's not only important for the animal's sake, but it's important for human's sake as well. My father suffers from diabetes, which he's had since his youth. And he, because of the diabetes, he gets tremendous nerve pain. Frequently, he suffers from tremendous nerve pain. There is almost nothing available to help with this nerve pain. It's a different kind of pain. It's not one that you can just give Tylenol, for example, to treat. It's a very specific type of pain. We have almost nothing to help him with that kind of pain. And so I've had to sit by again and again and watch him suffer from this kind of pain. Most diseases out there have little or absolutely no drug on the market for them. Most diseases. Our system is failing. Our system is failing. We need a better system. So that CCS's logo is, we need medical research needs to start and end with human biology. get rid of the other species, focus on human biology. That's the best way we're going to find the vaccines, the therapies that are going to be safe and effective in humans.
I would almost think that that wouldn't be such a hard sell, because I have limited experience in my day job is in IT, and a million years ago I actually had a contract at a pharmaceutical, and I saw sort of firsthand and learned that this is a very long cycle. It's like a 15-year cycle from concept to market. And so the pharmaceuticals, that's a big investment. That's a long time to get from point A to point Z. And a big part of that 15-year cycle, correct me if I'm wrong, has been those animal protocols. And it seems to me that what you're offering is that if you cut that chunk out, aren't you introducing an incredible efficiency? You're cutting that time of whatever it is. It's got to be a factor of years, no?
Yes, you are, because these new techniques, these human biology-based techniques, can be used more quickly. They can be streamlined. They can be used in what's called like a high-throughput way. So these tests using these human biology-based methods, and for example, we're talking about things like human organoids, mini organs grown in the lab, organs on a chip grown in the lab, tissues grown in the lab, for example, all human-based. These can be used and implemented and studied at a much faster rate than can occur with animal testing. But yeah, so a drug normally takes up to 15 years for development. One drug will take up to 15 years for development. So all that time, think of all the millions and hundreds of millions that may get invested into one drug. For it to ultimately fail is a huge hit, financially, at the very least, financially. In the meantime, people like my dad, people who suffer from Alzheimer's disease, people who suffer from Parkinson's disease, people who suffer from multiple sclerosis, have little or absolutely nothing to help them. And in the meantime, they are suffering because we are wasting time on ineffective animal experiments.
It almost seems like a no-brainer. Hey, tell me about the organoids. That sounded kind of interesting. Is that I have a science fiction kind of a thing going on in my head where you're building these little nanites or nano things and artificially, and they are taking the place or supplementing natural organs like livers and kidneys and that type of thing.
So organoids are miniature versions in a way. They capture they're like miniature representations of an entire organ. So there are mini there are organs like a heart organoid, which is a mini heart model that's been created. Cool. And they are human heart organs, cool. You know, the models, they are fully human. So that's the benefit about these models. And yes, you can create cardiac diseases in these models. You can study diseases. You can study a new vaccine. Well, you can study a new drug, whether it's going to be toxic, whether it's going to impact the certain markers that you need to show that it will be effective in actual clinical trials. So there's so much to these new methods. And they're being developed more and more and more frequently. The problem is, our government is still putting much more money and funding into animal testing than it is into these other types of testing methods. And we at CCS want to flip that. Yeah. We know we need to, for us to improve in biomedical research, we need to divest the funding away from animal testing and put it much more into developing and refining these human-based technology methods.
I would think, you know, on the one hand, I think what CCS is against is tradition. You know, this is the way it's always been done. But if you present a more cost-effective model, which is what you're suggesting, I mean, ultimately in the U.S., you know, the pharmaceuticals are our bottom line for-profit organizations, right? They're looking to make a profit just like everyone else is, and If you can demonstrate, like I was saying, cutting that cycle, using these organoids to be much more efficient, wouldn't that, once you can demonstrate that, do you see that you're going to have a much easier sell? I mean, is that your hump right now to demonstrate effectiveness or efficacy?
There are several different audiences that we're trying to work with, and pharmaceutical companies is one group of audiences. And yes, you're right. The pharma, they're going to do whatever it is to get their drugs to market more quickly and more effectively. The problem there is not necessarily pharma, but the Food and Drug Administration. Now, I worked at the Food and Drug Administration for 10 years, and they oversee drug development. They're still requiring animal testing. So until they change their regulation,
oh.
pharma will still do animal testing to appease FDA's.
FDA, sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you know, and I will say, in my 10 years at the FDA, I can't tell you how many internal meetings we had in which people recognize that animal experiments are ineffective, recognize it again and again, and yet they're still so reluctant to move away from it, just out of habit. It's what they know. It's the boxes they think that need to be checked off. And so they are so reluctant to move and change, even though we urgently need that change. So,
habit's the word. It's not just tradition. It's just, it's almost, I don't want to say, is it political? You know, everything's political right now, but it certainly seems like what I could see the apprehension would be that we know, or at least we know because we have the background of the tradition that says animal testing has always been the protocol, that if, God forbid, we ever moved away from that, moved into a model that doesn't involve animal, that nobody wants to be the first to do that.
Government inertia, right?
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's a duplication there. I think we just say government, and that equals inertia in so many ways. We're dealing with that. We're also dealing with an entrenched culture and bias within the biomedical world to a large degree.
Yeah.
Researchers have built their careers on using animals, on testing on animals, on publishing studies using animals. There, as you mentioned, there's a lot of big businesses involved for those who are breeding these animals or capturing them, importing them, like monkeys imported from Southeast Asia to be used for experimentation. There's a lot of different factors. But I will say, we are going to build a great momentum because the tide is slowly turning.
Yeah.
More and more researchers are saying, yes, we need to do better. We got to move away from animal testing.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, the time is right. Do you see just one last sort of item on it? Do you see any potential issues with broad umbrella of the word ethics? Somebody has to have been the first one to try this with bypassing the animal thing. You know, I'm trying to say, do you have to wrestle with that?
Human volunteers are putting their lives at risk right now because of animal testing.
Okay.
They're putting their lives at risk for something that has at least a 90% chance of failing. And 60 to 70% of the reason why that fails is because it's going to be unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
So you're putting, if I were a volunteer in a clinical trial, I would not want animal testing to be done, knowing how ineffective and unreliable it is. If anything, I would feel safer and more assured if I knew that the testing that was done, all the testing that was done before that drug was brought to me, was based on human biology.
Okay, listen, where can people go to get more information on CCS or any of your publications or works? Give people the skinny on it.
Sure. So we're the Center for Contemporary Sciences, or www.contemporarysciences.org.
Okay. I'd love to hear when you get your first trial, that your first, that bypasses them. I think that's going to be a real milestone in our evolution. So thanks. All right. That's Dr.
Aisha Akhtar,
Chairman and President of the CCS, Center for Contemporary Sciences. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me again, as always.
Okay. I think that was really informative. I really appreciate her time there. All right. Listen, we're going to break away. When we come back, we're going to have part one of my really intriguing conversation with Captain Paul Watson of Sea Shepherd. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Olivia Munn with my shelter pets, Frankie and Chance. Say hi, guys. When I adopted them, I discovered that they both have incredible personalities. Chance's sole purpose in life is to love and to be loved. Frankie is a little bit of a scoundrel and always entertaining. They're a little bit of a lot of things, but they're all pure love. Adopt pure love at theshelterpetproject.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council, the Humane Society of the United States, and Maddie's Fund.
Over the years, you have been hunted by the men who threw our goals. And in the long run, we will kill you.
All right, that's a little Crosby, Stills, and Nash there with their ode to the last whale, which if my next guest has anything to say about it, won't be for a very long time. So here now is my conversation with Captain Paul Watson. Captain Paul Watson is a Canadian-American marine conservation activist who founded the direct action group Sea Shepherd Conservation Society in 1977. He's been described as the world's most aggressive, most determined, most active, and most effective defender of wildlife. The Sea Shepherd's mission is to protect and conserve all marine wildlife, and today the movement has thousands of sea shepherds in over 40 countries working together on campaigns around the world. His recently published book, Orcapedia, A Guide to the Victims of the International Orca Slave Trade, chronicles the lives of individual orcas, both living and deceased, held in captivity throughout the world. Captain Watson, it's an honor to have you on.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
All right. Hey, so well, let's just start. So anyone who's maybe been living under a rock since 1977, why don't you give people the 101 on the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society? What is its roots? What is its mission? How has it grown?
I established the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society in 1977. I had been a founding director of the Greenpeace Foundation, and I decided to leave Greenpeace to set up Sea Shepherd as an alternative to protesting. So Sea Shepherd was set up to be an interventionist organization, specifically an anti-poaching organization. Mm-hmm. And along with that, I developed a strategy which I called aggressive nonviolence. And we're quite proud of our record that in 42 years, we've never caused a single injury to a single person, nor have we sustained any injuries, but we have shut down literally thousands of illegal activities around the world.
And all right, so how did you get in? I'm curious, when people, it's such an interesting background, even before Greenpeace, as a kid, how did you get into this? What, did you have a seminal moment?
Yes, I was raised in a fishing village in eastern Canada, and when I was 10 years old, I spent the entire summer swimming with a family of beavers in the forest nearby, and that was great fun. And the next summer, when I was 11, I went back to that pond, and there were no beavers. They had all been taken out by trappers that winter. And I got very, very angry. And that winter, the next winter, when I was still 11, I began to walk those trap lines and free the animals from the traps and destroy the traps. Oh, cool. I guess I've been doing the same thing ever since.
Did you actually see, as a kid, did you actually see the traps? Did you see the a beaver in a trap, or did you just saw the after effect?
No, I saw beavers in the traps, released beavers in the traps. I knew where the trap lines were. It was a small community. I knew who the trappers were.
Oh, you did?
Fortunately, yeah. They didn't know who I was.
Well, you were a kid and they were an adult, right?
Yes.
I mean, were you, did they ever catch you?
No, I wasn't caught. And, I would destroy the traps. I threw them in the river, actually. The one thing I did get in trouble with when I was 12 is I shot another kid in the rear end with a BB gun who was about to kill a bird. And Dixie Lee Ray, the former governor of Washington State, actually says in her book that evidence of Watson's insanity can be found that he shot a boy in the ass with a BB gun who was about to kill a bird. And she said any boy who would shoot another boy to protect a bird has to be insane. And my response to her was, well, you know, Dixie, in my hometown, every kid shot every other kid with a BB gun. I just happen to have a practical reason to shoot the kid that I did.
I think your insanity, well, that's a badge of honor there, right? You know, I don't mean to dwell on this, but I'm intrigued with this. Something when you saw the beaver in the trap, if you grew up in a fishing town, I mean, was your family, were your parents sensitive to that, or was that something that you were like an outcast? Or
my mother was very much into being kind to animals. My father was a hunter. But also, when I was around that age, I joined a club called the Kindness Club. And it was actually set up by the premier or the governor of the province of New Brunswick in Canada, Ida Fleming. And she has set this group up for children to be kind to animals. And the president was actually Albert Schweitzer. And later, Ida Fleming described me as the hitman for the Kindness Club.
But a hitman for the Kindness Club? I don't understand.
Because I was going around destroying the traps later.
Oh, okay.
But I was exposed to those kind of compassionate attitudes at that time. I was very much opposed to fishing and hunting, and you know, spent a lot of time disrupting those hunts when and where I could. So in 1969, when the Quakers and the Sierra Club got together in British Columbia to set up a group to oppose the testing of nuclear weapons in the Aleutian Islands, the island of Amchitka, they came for different reasons. The Quakers, of course, because it was a peace issue, and the Sierra Club because it was an environmental issue. I was actually the only person who came for a different reason, and that was because Amchitka Island was a wildlife preserve, and it was illegal to go onto the island with a gun, but here they were blowing up a 5-megaton bomb underneath it. In fact, with the previous test, had killed over 1,000 sea otters and seals from the shockwaves. So that was my motivation for getting involved in it. And we sailed up to oppose the bomb, and they set it off a day ahead of it before we arrived. But we certainly directed so much publicity to that particular issue that all further tests were canceled after that. So it was a successful campaign. Now, that group was called the Don't Make a Wave Committee. And at one of the early meetings, somebody left and flashed a peace sign, and Bill Darnell, who was one of our cook on the first boat, he said, and they made a peace sign and said peace, and he said, well, make it a Greenpeace. And Bob Hunter said, whoa, that's a great name for the boat. So we called the boat the Greenpeace. And in 72, we changed the name of the Don't Make a Wave Committee to the Greenpeace Foundation. And then I broke away from Greenpeace in 77 to set up the Sea Shepherd Conservation.
I was about to say, and the rest is history. I guess we could talk about, you know, the separation from Greenpeace and Sea Shepherd, but you could talk a little bit, you know, give us a little what really happened there in the breakaway. I mean, you hinted that there was basically a method, a question of tactics. Is that kind of what happened?
Yeah, I was the campaign leader for the projects to stop the seal hunt in the East Coast of Canada. I organized and led those campaigns. And during the 77 campaign, in order to save the life of a seal pup, I ran up to a sealer, grabbed his wrist, pulled the club out of his hand, threw it in the water, and rescued the seal. And at the time, Greenpeace didn't think anything of it, but then there was a power struggle within Greenpeace, and Patrick Moore became president of Greenpeace. And he had said that as soon as he became president, he would remove me, because he said that what I did was violent and illegal. And I said, well, I don't know. I was there to save the lives of seals, and I didn't hurt anybody. But anyway, so I was actually voted off the board of directors, not out of Greenpeace, but off the board of directors. And that's when I decided, you know, I really should go and set up an alternative, which is what I did. And the great thing about it is that I would say pretty much 80% of all of those directors within the next 10 years joined Sea Shepherd.
Yeah, it's fine. I just to back up a little bit, that story of you grabbing the stick, how is it possible? How this creature is the most innocent, sweet, docile looking thing, and for his heart to have been turned that cold that they just go out and do this without giving it a second thought. And the fact that you were able to just say, well, screw this, you're not going to do this. That's a moment of clarity, isn't it? Where you're just able to say, I don't care what the consequences are. How old were you when that happened? Now you're grown by this point, right? You're not a kid anymore.
Yeah, I was 25.
Yeah, I mean, and there was no doubt about it, right? You had to. And,
the cruelty that I witnessed out there was astounding. I mean, the pictures certainly don't convey just how horrible it was. I mean, I've seen seals that were skinned alive, kicked in the face. You know, I saw one guy pick up a pup, slung it over his shoulder, came up to where I was actually being held prisoner at the time. I was handcuffed by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. He threw it down in front of me and in front of the two officers, kicked it in the face, and then skinned it alive right in front of us. And I said to the two police officers, I said, he's in violation of the Seal Protection Act. And the first officer said, I didn't see anything. I says, well, you never do. And he said, and we never will. That was their attitude.
Wow.
So the whole thing was protected by the full authority of the Canadian government. And so they set up this thing called the Seal Protection Act, which was a bit of a farce, because under the Seal Protection Act, it was illegal to approach within a half a nautical mile of a seal hunt, illegal to photograph or film a seal being killed. Just witnessing the seal hunt was actually a crime. In fact, it still is a crime in Canada.
Just witnessing it is a crime.
If you're close enough to see a seal being killed, you've just broken the Seal Protection Act.
I don't understand. Unless you report it or try to prevent it, is that what the purpose of that?
No, you just have to be there. If you don't have a permit to be there.
I see. It's like AGAG in the U.S. Yeah, it's like,
you have a camera, if you're photographing or filming it, you can be charged under the so-called Seal Protection Act. No sealer's ever been charged under the Seal Protection Act.
Oh, it's to protect the sealers, not the seals.
It's a very Orwellian named rule.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
And to show you how they punish it, in 1983, I was charged for breaking the Seal Protection Act and conspiracy to break the Seal Protection Act. And here's what I was sentenced to. 15 months in prison for conspiracy, 6 months in prison for breaking the Seal Protection Act, a fine of $75,000, a confiscation of my ship, all of my crew members were fined, and I was forbidden to talk to any journalist anywhere in the world for 3 years on any subject. That was the sentence. So we went into court and we won in the Court of Appeals, and the whole thing was overturned. But that was actually what my original sentence was. And but I was eventually acquitted on those charges. And one of the reasons I was acquitted was that the Quebec Court of Appeals looked at it and said, this is outrageous, getting 21 months in prison for something like this. And they agreed that this was way over the top. But we had been before what we called the Judge Roy Bean of the SEAL campaign, who was you know, the Judge Yvonne Mercier, who was notorious for throwing the book at anybody who opposed the seal hunt.
I'm struck by sort of the parallels that was not recent. This is going back a few years. And on one hand, you want to think, you know, well, not a whole heck of a lot has changed. That we're still wrestling, at least, and I mentioned just a second ago, in the States with this concept of the ag-gag laws. It's the same deal, is that the law and the legislation is constructed to protect and enhance, really, the cruelty. And you, as one who's trying to oppose it, are seen as the criminal. It's astonishing, you know?
Not only are we viewed as criminals, we're viewed as terrorists.
Terrorists. Cameras.
Whoever thought that the camera would be a terrorist weapon? But I've always said all my life is that the most powerful weapon on the planet is the camera, you know, and that's why we go into battle with cameras, not with guns.
Yeah. Well, you're treading into one of my favorite topics on the show. I practically have to ask everyone that comes on, which is, what do you find? How do you temper your use of imagery when you use it as a weapon? If you present the image, let's say with a baby seal, I can't stand watching that, or, you know, where the guy's clubbing the baby. It's so repugnant and so repulsive that you simply look away. And if you were to show video images of that, do you run the risk of people turning away, not being able to look at it, versus, well, this is the reality of what's happening, you have to look at it? I'm just wondering, if for an organization like yours that relies so much on imagery, how do you balance that?
Well, we incorporate those imagery into the drama of what we do. You know, I've understood for 4 decades that the mainstream media only understands 4 elements: sex, scandal, violence, and celebrity. Every single story has one of those elements. If you have more than one, you got a bigger story. And 4 elements, you got a super story. So that's one of the reasons that we put together the Whale Wars show on Animal Planets and the documentaries that we put together. So what you do is you give them the drama of activism, intervention, and you work all those images in there, but you work them in a way that they're part of the story. It's not the main thrust of the images, but they're part of the story, and people get get the idea.
So in that case, you're talking motion picture, right? You actually have, it's not a static photograph, or it's not just a little 3-second show. It's within a context of a larger presentation. Yeah.
I have to say, it's always been a struggle with when we're dealing with the Animal Planet Network or the various documentaries. It's always been a struggle because they want to take these things out. And of course, my argument is, well, then what's the point? You know, I mean, we're trying to show why we're there. Why are we so aggressive in opposing this? Well, here's why we're so aggressive.
Right. And it sounds like the way you do it too is that you have, because it's embedded almost within, that there's not enough time to turn around, to turn away. That it's part of, almost subliminal. It's not going that fast, but that the image is going by as part of the overall thing. That it's like, okay, and the image may already be gone before the person has a moment for it to register just how really offensive this was, right?
You don't really want to, you know, push the image so long that people become sort of revolted or
distant. Yeah.
But you get it in there fast. But again, sometimes it's good. I mean, you get films like Earthlings and things like this. I mean, sometimes you just got to ram it down people's throats.
Yeah.
At the point. But there's different levels, of course, of that. I've always actually been opposed to a lot of the films that show a lot of really extreme violence, only on the fact that they tend to show those films only to people who've already part of this movement. You know, and we don't need to see it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We need to get it out to people who haven't seen it. So, for instance, when you put these images out on the street, as people have done, where people walking by say, "Oh my God, what's that?" Well, this is how your meat's produced. then they start to think about it, you know.
Yeah.
So I've seen a lot of that. I guess that would be guerrilla tactics, guerrilla media tactics in a way, and it works.
I mean, I can see that. Yeah. And I was thinking, as you're describing that, it's been around now for several years now, but the billboards that where the image is only up for a few seconds, you know, 4 or 5 seconds. And I was wondering, like, why the animal rights organizations kind of haven't taken more advantage of that.
Well, animal rights organizations as well as environmental organizations tend to not be very sophisticated. They are getting better, but they tend not to be so sophisticated on understanding the rules of media.
Yeah.
You know, you can learn a lot from Coca-Cola and politicians on how to do that. but the problem we live in a media culture. Media defines reality. And I say, if it's not on camera, it didn't happen. It doesn't matter what you say.
Yeah.
It didn't happen.
Think about that since the advent of the smartphone, right? everything is on camera now, where it wasn't before. You know, nothing. I mean, that's where we're seeing all this. I think all this action in terms of Black Lives Matter. You know, and all the police actions, because everything. You know, all these events that would have been that have happened in the last few years, as recently as 10 years ago, before the storm, no one would have heard or seen about them.
It's easy to dismiss and discredit anybody who is opposing the word of a police officer. Yeah. But suddenly. Here's the image. You can't dispute the image.
Yeah. All right. So this makes for an interesting, that sounded really like I was really setting that up and I didn't, but I want to make an interesting segue, speaking of Black Lives Matter. And that is this really fascinating book that has just been published, Orcopedia, A Guide to the Victims of the International Orca Slave Trade. And the approach that that you've taken to the book is you've really individualized each of the orcas, each of them, right? So it's not like, and I'm going even beyond the concept of giving them a name. Obviously, they have a name. But you're, even as you describe them in the book, you have terminology that normally we would reserve, or we think we would reserve for, quote unquote, humans, right? And I'm thinking words like victims, inmates, prisons, right? These, when we use these words, we tend to always, naturally being the anthropocentric creatures that we are, we tend to always think of them in terms of people, humans. But what I'm wondering, and this is going to be really loaded, but as Black Lives Matter unfolded, you know, a couple months ago, I had a couple people on, and I was really, I want to say chastised, but I was told, you know, be very careful that we're not going to ever compare the mistreatment of any non-human animals to the this concept of slavery. And yet, I don't think there's no doubt about it that in Orcopedia, that is exactly what you do. It's in the subtitle. You refer to that as the orca slave trade. I just wonder if you could talk about that for a second. Is that dangerous? Is it dangerous to make that comparison to slavery and how loaded that is given the current environment?
I don't see how truth can ever be dangerous. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess you could be accused of a lot of things, but it is a slave trade. These are highly intelligent, socially complex, self-aware, sentient beings that are being caught and enslaved and killed prematurely. I mean, there's been 218 orcas that have been captured, of which 162 are now dead, and 56 which are presently being held in these concrete aquatic cells, and for the amusement of human beings.
I don't mean to dwell on it, but it's so loaded, it's so fraught that here's an example. When I was reading on the air a response to a Black Lives Matter comparison, and the post, this was a Twitter post, was trying to make the case, sort of like what you're just saying, is that, well, if you're that, this process that you go through to dehumanize a race, in this case, African-Americans, is the same process you go through when you dehumanize is the wrong word, but when you depersonalize, when you take the sentience, the fact that you can have feelings or be responsive to a non-human animal, and that it is the same thing. That is the same process that you go through. You are taking the sentience out of the equation for your own benefit. And the online response was, so are you saying, it was a great indignance, are you saying that being beaten by a cop is equivalent to me eating a ham sandwich? That was the response. And in other words, well, you're trivializing the experience of the African American being beaten by the police, and you're making it as, because you're comparing it to a pig being slaughtered in a factory. And to me, I don't know what you think. I think that's exactly it. But to even suggest that raises, like, what is wrong with me? Like, how can you even dare say such a thing? How can you trivialize it? I just wonder if you could talk about it, because it's the same process, certainly with orcas, right?
It's not trivializing. It's brutality is brutality. Murder is murder. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what, the victims are the victims.
So that is part one of my conversation. Now we're gonna get into that in a lot more detail next week. But we had to sort of draw a line there. But you definitely want to follow up with us next week as we get into a lot more detail with that concept. One thing, you know, it's funny, as I was listening to the conversation again, I don't know if you're listening to the show for a while, but his description of when he grabbed the stick from the seal hunter, Really, it resonated with, it reminded me of my conversation with Inker Newkirk and her story, how she grabbed the stick from the guy that was beating the cow. It's really, the parallels are almost uncanny that both of them had that moment where there's clarity and there's no question about it. All right, like I said, you definitely want to check back next week to hear the rest of the conversation. So it's a quick break. When we come back, Dr. Tom Ricard is going to talk to us about the common dog illnesses and what to do about them. Don't go away.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Ricard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
We think our vet is very helpful. We think our vet is smart and nice. Our vet takes such good care of us, but would rather stay home. Would rather be home to catch mice.
And we're back here on The Other Animal on WWDB, joined now by Dr. Tom Ricard of All Pets House Calls. Hey, Tom, how's life?
Okay. Well, I'll just warn people, I'm not going to be descriptive, but you still might want to put down your breakfast, you know, if you're a little weak.
Oh, we got a good one today. I can't wait. I mean, yeah, good one. I mean, let me just put down all my all the thing that I don't want to see coming in the other direction. So, all right, what do you got for us? It's dogs this week,
because
right?
Because the subject is, well, we've talked that one of the biggest things seen is in dogs and cats is allergies and skin problems, and we've talked about them and probably will in the future. But a big one and probably one of the most difficult to deal with on many levels for owners is vomiting and or diarrhea. So when that happens and it's in your house, it is not a small problem. so it depends on the size of your dog or cat, I suppose.
Oh yeah, there's that too, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's larger animal, larger problem for sure.
Yeah.
Basically, I give people the first thing to think about is a dividing line. If you have your animals had dogs, we're talking about today, but this applies to a lot of cats too. If they have vomited or had diarrhea, first thing you ask yourself, are they acting like they always do, kind of happy, you know, active, wagging their tail, seem purring, if it's a cat we'll talk about too, or are they acting sick? Do they seem like they feel really miserable? That's a big dividing line. Mm-hmm. If they are acting like themselves and just seem fine, but they just have happened to have a vomiting or diarrhea episode, that's generally a good sign. It's not, you know, you're totally out of the woods, but that's often a sign that just something they put in their mouth aggravated them, and this is their body's way of getting rid of it. And hopefully that's the end of it. We never even maybe know what it was over half the time. But it could be as simple as the exact same food you always give them. Nothing has changed. The flavor's the same. But maybe somebody in the factory changed the ingredients just enough to set off your pet's stomach. That probably happens way more than we think. Usually the first line of defense for this type of thing is I tell people to just take up their food. Don't give them anything else the rest of the day, preferably for anywhere from 12 to 24 hours. And it's just because no matter what causes vomiting or diarrhea, generally what happens is the inside lining of their stomach and intestinal tract gets irritated. It gets inflamed even, which is why we'll see blood often in animal stool. That's a very scary thing to see in human beings. It's very common in dogs and cats and other animals.
So
when people see that, they freak out and understand.
Yeah, I was going to say, I just want to clarify. So you're saying that chill that if you see that, it's a little concerned, but it's not the same. It's not the it doesn't necessarily bode the same type of terror as if you see it in a human. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And that's something to keep in mind, because I do get a lot of very scared and understandable phone calls. There's blood in my animals, you know, particularly it's usually stool, but, you know, it's sometimes vomit even. And it's like, yeah, we don't want to hear about that. We don't want that to be the case, but this is significantly a common finding in animals, whereas in people, it's a very bad sign usually. Mm-hmm. So it just means they get super inflamed, animals. And that's one of the reasons I'll have them stay off of food for 24 hours. When you're trying to eat something, food passes by your the digestive enzymes of the intestinal tract from the pancreas and things like that, aggravate an already aggravated bowel. So you do not want to keep that bowel awake, active, and putting pancreatic digestive enzymes out into it, because it's just going to get worse. So they may be hungry. They may look at you with big, sad eyes, like, where's my dinner? You got to just resist for the next 12 to 24 hours.
I just want to go back. So you said that the root cause, this is really, because if I would think as a pet owner, I would have the same kind of confusion that you just described, that I didn't change my dog's diet. I'm giving the exact same stuff in the exact same quantities, you know, and yet you're saying that there is a potential, we think it's consistent, but it really may not be, that you know, whatever the manufacturer of the producer of the particular food, they just can't guarantee consistency.
It just happens, you know. It's probably a lot more common than we think. It's just a little switch in maybe the level of ingredients. That's one of the things. Another big thing, though, is that even though people will say to me, no, my pet never, like, eats anything that they shouldn't, you'd be surprised. If you look at their toys, you'll see little pieces that have come off. So maybe fuzz, if it's some sort of a stuffed
animal.
See, I
would see that I could see that as a much more common, like something. It would just really freak me out to know that my food, the dog's normal food is causing, versus there has to be a variable, something different, you know, just for peace of mind. I think
it's very common. Right? It's fairly common. Another thing that's common we don't realize is that if you've had visitors to your house, they might not even admit it, but they slipped your pet like a potato chip or something like that.
There
you
go.
And then they'll say, no, I didn't give him anything.
No, guess again.
Especially,
right?
When they see there's been a problem.
Yeah. All right. Hey, listen, Tom, that's we're out of time. That's really helpful. And so I'm really curious to hear part three of this next week. So I hope we can get into a little more deep. All right. Listen, I want to thank my engineer, Jason Duffy, and also welcome him back from his marriage. Always would love to hear from you with your comments, ideas, or suggestions. If there are topics you'd like Dr. Picari to address, just check out theotheranimals.com. Let us know. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter at @theotheranimals. Same with Facebook. Don't forget to check out our partner podcasters at iroarpod.com. Next week, as I said, we're going to continue our conversation with Captain Paul Watson. Really going to get into it. You're not going to want to miss that. And we're going to be talking with Nicole Forsyth from Red Rover. This is an organization that helps reunite rescued animals after a disaster, such as the fires out in California. And it gets their companion animals back with their companions. Really, really important organization. Really, really neat stuff that they do. So we'll see you then. And until then, find a belly to rub. Stay safe, everyone.